Good evening and welcome to Tuesday Topics. I'm Paul Edwards from Miami, Florida, and I'd like to welcome all of you to another edition of the program that allows blind people and others to discuss issues of concern to our community. Let me begin by thanking Larry T., who's our sole recorder this evening in Orlando, Florida, and George Byes of Talking Community, who has made this kind of chat room possible. Last week, we began our discussion of the Americans with Disabilities Act and really spent a lot of time trying to discuss just how effective it had been for blind people and how effective it hadn't been. And this week, we thought we would explore perhaps how the ADA has gotten to where it is, also explore a little bit what the future of the ADA may hold. Our intent, then, is to spend a little bit of time today trying to paint some elements of the ADA picture that actually are not very pretty. When the ADA was introduced in 1990 and signed in 1990, there was a period of immense hopefulness in the part of the disability community, and I think this hopefulness was similar to that accompanied Section 504's passage. And as with Section 504, that hopefulness gradually turned into a degree of sadness as we began to see, as time went on, more and more decisions made by courts of law that didn't appear to support the ADA. And we also began to see instances where the media would pick on specific decisions that were being arbitrated or, in fact, were the result of suits, and would almost ridicule them to the point of making it seem as though people with disabilities really had no needs, and that all of the suits that were being filed under the ADA were frivolous. And I guess where we might begin tonight is to talk a little bit about some of those. Does anyone remember any of the frivolous ADA suits and how the media covered them so that we can begin to get a picture of what the media has done and what its impact has been?
This is Pam Drake in Visalia, California. Certainly the person who filed the suit was... did not think it was frivolous, but there was an apartment complex or a condo someplace where a woman filed a suit regarding ragweed. She said the ragweed was making it difficult for her to breathe. I think they found in her favor, so all the nicer shrubbery had to go away because this woman was complaining about asthma. Now, a friend of ours was trying to get a job with one of the, I think it was United Parcel or one of the big companies, and she was told that she could not bring her guide dog because there was a woman at the other end of the office who had asthma, and the dog would make it hard for her to breathe. Well, they took the other woman's concerns over Linda's. And Linda said, "Well, I can keep my dog in the other end of my, you know, she doesn't live anywhere near, she doesn't sit anywhere near me. I can move I can move as far as I need to." They were all ready. They had the blood test done, the drug test done, all of that stuff. And then as soon as the other person complained, they said, "Nope." And all of a sudden, she just didn't hear anything anymore. And it was all squarely put on the idea that the ADA gave them the latitude to do this.
It sounds like, in the first instance, Pam, that you were a little sympathetic with the apartment complex in Marin County. Would that be accurate?
Marin County is rather upper crust and likes to remind you of that, same. So I don't have allergies, so I have an allergy to a fly that's about to get it, but no, I don't know if I thought that ragweed, maybe I did think that the fuss over ragweed was a bit much. Yes, maybe I did.
And I think that's actually pretty typical of the American public, that many of the issues that people were raising, even though they may have been relevant to the individual who filed the suit, were perceived by people in this country and often by the media as well, as perhaps overreaching what people needed to. So ragweed was one instance.
I know the media, and maybe that's where I got my opinion from. I hope not, but maybe it did color my perception, no pun intended. They certainly weren't sympathetic. And there was a show, one of John Stossel's programs on ABC, did a whole hour on everything from overweight people to the ragweed issue to a lot of such items, and the media was not sympathetic at all.
This is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan, and a lot of people these days declare themselves disabled because of a number of reasons, and I mean, some people declare that because they're overweight, that's a disability, and some people even I don't know if this had anything to do with the AIDS, but even the AIDS controversy, some people think that they got AIDS, they got disability.
There was a couple that brought their guide dogs with them to on vacation in a resort area, and because they made all the arrangements ahead of time, you know, got the doctor's permission and all that, medical records to go to this place, and they even asked the hotel manager ahead of time if they could bring the dog, and said, planned everything ahead, and when they got there at the last minute, the hotel manager that said yes changed his mind after they got there.
There were a couple of cases that have been particularly interesting in the history of the ADA in terms of the kinds of cases that have been filed. One of them that garnered a lot of attention here was a demand to create wheelchair access to the nude beach here. And the media had lots of fun with that. There have been a number of cases, such as the American Airlines cases, where two twins with somewhat impaired vision were denied pilot privileges, and essentially because they had perfect vision with glasses, it was determined by the courts that they didn't qualify under the ADA. And that was eventually a decision that was in fact upheld by some fairly high courts within the United States. In the case of the ragweed, in the case of the nude beach, and in the case of some of the other instances that Pam and Dave have discussed, one of the things that they said, and it's very significant, is, you know, I heard about these cases, and maybe it was through the media, but I have no idea how they came out. And that's one of the insidious but significant things about the media treatment of the ADA. They raise these absolutely abhorrent stinks about ADA cases that they believe are inappropriate. But if they report what the outcome of that case was, they do so on page 42, between two ads for cat food. So the American public isn't aware of what the results are. Many of the cases that are brought under the ADA are rejected by the courts virtually immediately, and the media never bothers to say that. Instead, they allow the ADA to get tarred and feathered as if it's a bad law, and as if all of the suits that are being filed are frivolous. And for the most part, there's very little coverage of the suits that really do demonstrate real discrimination until they get awfully far in the process, i.e., for instance, to the Supreme Court.
Kind of says something to the unfairness as far as the treatment that the disabled get by the media in these situations, you know.
Yeah, I think it does, Gary. And the media therefore contributes to the way that society sees the law and therefore encourages people who are comfortable with limiting the applicability of the ADA to go ahead and do that. So I think the media has played a substantial role in the narrowing of the focus of the ADA. Let's take an example. Probably the most cogent example was the Lane case in the Supreme Court. When the case was being argued in Tennessee, it essentially received no press coverage. And when the case was being argued in the Federal Court of Appeals, it essentially received very little coverage as well. But suddenly when it became a Supreme Court case, everybody took a look at it, and there were these images that were shown all the time of people in wheelchairs crawling up the steps to get inside a courthouse. And those images actually, I think, probably played an important role in helping some of the justices of the Supreme Court to recognize that this was a pretty serious issue. So if we get good coverage from the media for good ADA cases, I think the chances are that we'll end up with an ADA that begins to do good things. So the first reason then why the ADA hasn't been successful is because very negative coverage and very unfair coverage by the media of the ADA virtually ever since it was introduced. And it goes hand in hand, by the way, with the fact that the media doesn't do a good job of recognizing just how seriously disadvantaged people with disabilities are. Let's make the assumption that the unemployment rate is 10 or 11% among African Americans or Hispanics. The fact is that the unemployment rate is around 70% among people with disabilities, assuming we believe the Harris poll, and we probably shouldn't entirely. But the fact is it's very high. The media tends to be very concerned about the high African American unemployment rate, but seems to find excuses for the high unemployment rate among people with disabilities. Well, it's because they can't work, or it's because they aren't well enough trained. But it isn't because there's blatant discrimination. It isn't because employers are using any excuse they can manage to avoid hiring people with disabilities. So again, the media has a double standard. They cover other disadvantaged groups far more readily and far more openly and honestly than they cover people with disabilities. Probably the only group that may be in the same kind of position as we are lesbians and gays, who I think sometimes get pretty poor media coverage as well.
It's interesting because everybody, I think, complains about the media from whatever their standpoint is. The conservatives complain about the media being liberally biased. The liberals complain about the Fox News Network being conservatively biased. We complain about the media being, biased against us. And I think there's probably truth in all of it. The media has become, rather than a true information source that it used to be, I think the media has now become just another entertainment venue by and large, and that's partly where our problem is. So naturally, when people see people didn't see the wheelchairs on the nude beach, they saw the nude beach, and you know it's those 10-second sound bites that get us in trouble. I don't know since that seems to be the way the media works, I think we have to figure out a way to work to make it work for us. Now, I also think one of the issues that has come to the forefront, and Gary kind of mentioned it, is that everybody wants to be disabled when it's convenient. Okay, those two twin pilots wanted to be disabled because, you know, classified as disabled because it was convenient for them to, you know, to be adjudicated as disabled so that they could get their pilot's license. But by golly, if they were in the real world as disabled, they wouldn't be. I think that's a real problem and a real weakness in ADA is that I believe that it was initially to be narrowly interpreted, and it's the rather wide latitude that we're trying to give it that's getting us all in trouble.
Yeah, this is Larry T. in Orlando, Florida, and I would agree with that. It's like, as far as the media is concerned, they're going to look for anything that's going to produce the most attention from the listening audience, whether it's putting down somebody or anything that's negative, you know, any negative thing they're going to bring out in a hurry. And as far as anything as far as the ADA is concerned, yeah, a lot of people think it's frivolous because there's people out there that milk it, you know, when they really don't need the services. And it's just kind of crazy. You just got to find that fine line. And as far as media is concerned, I think you listen to that song Dirty Laundry by Don Henley. That'll say it all right there.
I was listening to one of our local stations a couple of years ago, and there was a news report going on about detachable warnings. And I kind of went, hello? And obviously it was detectable, and they're going out of detachable warnings. So I called the station, and I said, it's detectable warnings. Okay, I'll tell them. And I'm like, okay. Their people are wondering what the heck are detachable warnings, and nobody is correcting it. I sat there for another hour, didn't hear either they got it wrong and didn't check it out, or they just didn't want to be bothered. I don't know. That kind of bugged me.
Hi, it's Debbie Hazelton from South Florida, and I remember reading somewhere, I remember talking about this, I don't know where I read it, but that in many cases disability is not even included as a minority with the list of different types of minorities. I don't think it's because we're viewed as being in the majority. I think it's because we're forgotten, we're ignored. And I think it goes back to that, you know, tremendous fear that people have of disability. And so I think it makes it a lot harder to get the recognition in a lot of the ways that we need it to get the proper cases heard and to get the proper terminology and all that kind of thing.
If you were to ask most media outlets how they feel about people with disabilities, they would tell you, we're very sympathetic and we would like to do anything as an entity to try to forward and help people with disabilities. The difficulty is that there is a real disconnect, I think, in the media, so that people who are disabled, who actually begin to attack the beliefs that have been ingrained by the media in our society, i.e. that people with disabilities are to be pitied and are helpless, is an upstart and is viewed in the same way as an extreme black power advocate was in the late 60s or early 70s. And I think that one of the things that we've somehow not done a good job of getting across is that it's okay to validate and feel sorry for people who are disabled at the same time as we recognize that one of the ways that they can be helped is by extending the rights that the law accords them. the media has not done a good job of understanding how you put those two things together.
Yeah, that's right. I think that they look at more of us as something to be pitied or sorry, be felt sorry for, instead of something that we want to declare our equal rights with the rest of society. You know?
So the media, it has certainly had an impact on the way that the ADA has been perceived by our society. Another factor, I think, has been the kinds of cases that have been brought under the ADA. We talked about some of those cases that are frivolous, but we probably also need to talk about a phenomenon that we have to own here in South Florida, which was the creation of what amounted to an ADA legal suit machine that was set up and, in fact, was called the ADA, which stood for Action for Disabled Americans. And they garnered an immense amount of unfavorable publicity because what they did was they went all over the countryside citing Title III entities, filed suit against them, and according to many accounts, even some in fairly disability-friendly elements as well, they worked with these guys to come up with what amounted to a settlement that A, paid legal fees, and B, hired disabled people as consultants to do surveys and a range of other things that they would then end up adopting, and often did not do a good job of meeting the needs of all people with disabilities, but instead left glaring violations of the ADA post-settlement in many cases. And it was, in fact, this particular organization and a couple of others that were clones here in Florida that persuaded Congress to introduce this obnoxious piece of legislation that says that a Title III entity has the right to wait 90 days before they need to respond to a complaint. And they have 90 days to try to redress things before you can even file a complaint, which is, on the face of it, pretty ludicrous. But I think that was another factor that has impacted the way that the Americans with Disabilities Act is perceived. And also has impacted, I think, the way that people with disabilities and their needs are perceived. Many people have the notion that what the ADA is simply a way for lawyers, some of whom are disabled, to get rich on the backs of poor small business people who are suffering and are likely to go out of business because of the pressure that the ADA is providing.
We have the same problem here, and I can't say that I don't understand why people are wanting these obnoxious rulings like these 90-day rules. If they think they're going to get sued out of existence, of course they're going to fight back. We have to expect that. How do we police our own? We can't. So what do we do?
Well, I think the first question we have to ask ourselves is whether or not the suits are in fact appropriate or not. And in the South Florida cases, one of the difficulties is that I don't know of a single suit that was brought by this organization against an entity that was making a good faith effort to comply with the ADA. I think that in every case, these suits were brought after attempts were made by people with disabilities to persuade the local Title III entities to actually do something to fix the problems. The difficulty is that they may not have become, or they may not have been as careful in devising the settlements that they agreed to. I'll give you a perfect example. Pam will probably recognize this. One of the more famous places where blindness and low vision are treated is the Bascom-Palmer Eye Hospital. And an ADA complaint was filed against them. And even though some of the people filing that complaint were in fact folks who were blind, the fact is that the people who drove the settlement were folks with other disabilities. And so here you had finally a settlement that was proposed for agreement that made no mention of Braille signage, that made no mention of training for the staff so that they knew how to treat people who were blind and so on. And so it isn't so much, I think, that the suits are inappropriate, and that's part of the problem. It's that the settlements aren't. Another example that another whole class of examples that ACB has had to deal with, along with other organizations of and for the blind, are suits that are brought against national chains concerning accessibility, where the intent is to arrive at an overarching settlement that will apply across the board. In so many of these cases, like Circle K and some others, settlements are made without taking the needs of people who are blind into consideration. And all that we've been able to do is to simply ask to be removed as a class from these settlements, because what's there for us is simply not sufficient to justify a settlement, and we don't want to take away our right to try to make things better by appearing to accede to a settlement that clearly doesn't meet our needs. So these are some other elements that are certainly operating on the ADA spectrum now, which make things difficult.
Well, yeah, I think it's a bad deal that that we can't. I mean, like this thing with the Braille signage, and they had a settlement that didn't include those things that were necessary for us. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Those are two factors: bad cases that garnered bad publicity, and a gradual narrowing of the ADA and court decisions. One of the biggest factors that began to emerge as the ADA evolved was the use of the 13th and 14th Amendments, but in particular the 14th Amendment, which indicated that the governments of states were sovereign entities, and that unless there was an overriding justification to mess with them, state laws ought to be regarded as sacrosanct, and the federal government ought not to get in the middle. An instance where it was decided that it was okay for the feds to get involved was with some of the electoral laws that were passed in the 1960s, because it was argued that states, in fact, had been given lots of time to fix electoral inequities and to avoid denying the ability to vote to people who were of African American descent, for instance. What Congress said is there is an overarching justification for our getting involved. What was said in a number of ADA cases is the 14th Amendment protects the sovereign immunity of states and protects their right to the primacy of their laws, and Congress hasn't clearly and unequivocally stated that the ADA is sufficient grounds for overriding this immunity, and therefore we're going to argue that the state is protected against suits under the ADA because the ADA shouldn't be applied to states because of the 14th Amendment.
Now, it seemed like when it comes to civil rights or human rights, they ought to supersede states' rights. Then, it seems like.
Well, the problem, and of course, the probably the most famous case that would call that particular element of the Constitution into question would be Garrett versus Woods in Alabama. And the problem there, again, is were these people truly disabled under ADA? And there were two of them, of course. A woman with, I believe, a breast cancer issue. Illness, no doubt. And whether, again, and a man, some kind of a smoke, a tobacco allergy or something. The problem is, you know, you get these bad cases breed bad law, and you just wonder how much of this. It's real hard for me to sit here and say, you know, without sounding heartless, I don't want to be, but some of these cases that are brought to the Supreme Court in 80 should never or really have to do with people who truly aren't disabled and really has no place under ADA, and yet they make ADA law. And again, I don't know what the solution is there. Probably none.
This is Larry in Orlando. It just goes back to, there's people out there who will milk the system for whatever it is. If they see a benefit for being disabled, they're going to claim a disability if they can find one. And if there's a chance of it ruining their image, they'll back away from it in a heartbeat. There's just people out there who don't care. They try to take advantage of everything they could possibly get and don't want to work honestly for it.
I think it's probably important to recognize that at least in a very narrow way, the Garrett case was remanded backwards, and again, it's an indication of the media. It wasn't well covered, but in fact, the folks in the Garrett case have actually been able to file suit and actually did end up collecting some damages because of the fact that the case was remanded backwards. I think the other thing we need to recognize is that the ADA was passed at a time when we were moving towards a very conservative position among justices in the Supreme Court. So that, whereas probably in the 1970s or the 1960s or even the 1980s, the Supreme Court was probably a little to the left of where many of the governments of the United States were, I think clearly the Supreme Court now is arguably so conservative and constructionist in the way that they're dealing with decisions, that any decision that demands an extension of the validity of federal laws that they can possibly avoid making, they will.
Where do some of these cases go? I filed a case against my employer, and where it went was that we settled. And so it didn't see the light of day outside the Tulare County. Actually, it did get very brief press coverage that was heard statewide over a news network. But I don't know how many other people have been in that situation, but I didn't want any more coverage than we got. I would have been happy if that had been, that coverage had gone away. Because what they don't tell you in the real life is that everybody makes life really uncomfortable for you, when you prevail or nearly prevail in a case. And, it's not fun. Now, again, in California, our laws are a little bit more stringent than ADA, so that was another reason, you know, it did not go the federal route.
Help us to understand why winning an ADA case, or potentially winning an ADA case, or almost winning an ADA case, has a tendency to make you uncomfortable, or to make one uncomfortable. If you can discuss it in terms of your own personal situation, fine. But if not, try to at least analyze your feelings and help us to understand why it is that a disabled person who essentially is being vindicated by the courts feels uncomfortable.
I can really only tell you from my standpoint, a part of the settlement for this case was that I leave county employment and that I not bother them anymore, basically. Before I left, I needed to get in 25 years, so there was a period of 6 to 7 months there when basically they could come to my home if they wanted to and assign me work at home. I wanted them to leave me alone. I wanted out of it. I didn't want any more, you know, If they weren't going to have me work in the office, I didn't want to be employed, period. That was the, and that was my... And so it was... It's because a total vindication, it was not a total, and of course, as all settlements go, there was no wrongdoing admitted. And that's typical of any settlement. I see Joe Harch is on the list here, and I know that he'll verify that is, you know, typical of any settlement. In retrospect, you know, it was my attorney that wanted to settle because he saw the jury we were getting, and it was not good. You know, they were not going to, you know, abide by the law. They were going to abide by gut feeling, and it would not have gone in our favor. So yes, in terms of especially in a smaller area where you've got to work around these people and you've got to live around them, you have to be a little careful. Especially if you're collecting money damages, as I did at least to a degree.
I was talking to someone who knows a little bit about juries, and he said that half of them, you ask a juror why they voted chose in favor of the defendant, and they said, "I didn't understand the case," and like there was no way. Unfortunately, the average educational level here is so marginal. I hate to say it. A lot of them, people here haven't even graduated high school. And the rest of them worked for the county. So, or had friends in the county and relatives in the county. So the deck was just incredibly stacked. And they did everything they could to try and make him resign, but he wasn't going to. So it was a very ugly episode in our lives.
The Chief Justice of the United States is currently not in good health at all, and that eventually he will either die or he will step down from the Supreme Court. That means that there will essentially be two appointments which are available for the Supreme Court, and so there's a lot of interest in who's likely to fill those positions. I don't know if anybody would like to comment on who is likely to fill those positions and what that will mean for the ADA.
This is Joe Hartson, and just a little bit of history of the Supreme Court and how people are interpreting it. Many of these states' rights cases go back to what I call judicial activism in the negative, in a case in the 1890s called Hines v. Louisiana, in which the courts ruled that an individual could not sue his own state for money damages for civil rights violation. When the 11th Amendment clearly says that one cannot sue another state for money damages, it was used as an excuse to protect the Jim Crow laws. In that same case law, you know, here more than 110 years later, 115 years later, was at the heart of the Garrett case. Now, what many people don't understand is the Garrett case, even as bad as that was, did not say that one could not sue a state actor. It also, but it said that one could not sue for money damages, even in their own state. Again, I will call this hypocrisy on the court's behalf, because it is really not a strict interpretation of the United States Constitution. The other thing that I really wanted to comment on, and that goes to the core of all this, is that even people like Jeffrey Sutton or Roberts, who is now up for the Supreme Court and one of these members of the Federalist Society, who I think will breeze through the nomination, one of the things that they all agree on, and even the most conservative, like Rehnquist, is that a federal agency in enforcing the civil rights of individuals or class, such as the U.S. Department of Justice, can sue the states, can sue for money damages and collect those for the individual, and can send a message. So this boils down to political will. When has the U.S. Department of Justice sued a state actor? Sued, not settled, not mediated, anything else, a state actor? Very rarely. They very rarely even come in as a friend of the court. When the Civil Rights Act came about in 64, that was enforced by political will. That was enforced, the integration mandate in the South in the Voting Rights Act was enforced at the end of a federal bayonet. What we do not have is a will to enforce our civil rights by these federal agencies. And so that leaves individuals to go to courts and to get various interpretations of courts. Sometimes there's bad cases, and bad cases make bad case law. And the final comment in some of the vein here is much of the ADA was geared toward mediation and settlement, of which Dave correctly points out there is not a track record and there's not precedent. I know an individual who is blind who's actually won money damages above and beyond what they'd ever get in court in three different cases, including, you know, from public accommodations. But there is no record of it. You know, there is no precedence in court. And that is a very real problem. I will end with this. There were two things that came across my radar screen today that were important. One of them is that on one ADA list that I'm on, that the Department of Justice was called on the map and the USX on the map by many people with disabilities for continually holding conferences and forums about the ADA itself in places that were not fully 100% accessible to people that use wheelchairs and other accommodations. And the comment that people like John Wodrich in the past have made is that we'd never be able to hold an event because there aren't enough places that are accessible, which is testament to the abysmal failure in enforcement by this federal agency.
I hope this is not too far off topic, but we are talking about the Chief Justice and the fact that he is ill. What happens if a justice must, if he dies? Do they simply go on, and maybe I don't know enough about it, but do they appoint someone? Does the president try to find someone temporarily? Does the Congress? I mean, what happens? Because we'll have, because it's a 5-4, 4-5, that'll be a pretty slim balance. What happens?
I would think that if an appointee to the court dies in office, I would think that the president would have to appoint someone else for that.
Yeah, Gary's right. The objective is to try to fill Supreme Court positions pretty quickly. So we are approaching the end of our program, and I guess the question that we have really come to is, what is the future of the ADA? Is it likely to grow stronger? Is it likely to grow weaker? And what is perhaps most important, what can we, either as ACB or as individuals, do to forward the interests of the ADA, assuming that we want to do that?
Life went on without ADA before 1990, and life will go on without ADA in 2000, whatever, if that happens. Our job is to see that we as blind people, and blind people first, and this is where I may be hypocritical, and disabled people second, are accorded reasonable treatment, ADA or no ADA. And I, for one, have been one to not really depend on federal legislation for my survival. And I think that, you know, there's a certain amount of control that we don't have that we need to, but there is control that we do have, and that is over ourselves and our own beings, and I think each one of us has a responsibility to make sure that we in our own lives are able to lead as productive and as satisfying lives as we know how.
It's Larry in Orlando. And I would say, you know, life, I would agree life would go on, you know, if ADA goes. But if you wanted to survive, like anything else, if you don't like what's going on, you just got to get out there and vote. That's one of the biggest things you got to do if you want to try to swing, you know, the courts and everything else, you know, the other direction that you want it to go, is get everybody out there and vote.
Hi, it's Debbie Hazelton again. I agree in part that I think it is for each of us to take care, you know, take care of ourselves and to work in a day-to-day way to make things better for ourselves as people who are blind. But I think it would be absolutely horrific if the ADA went away. We say life would go on, but I think that as soon as we would go to stand up for our rights, that's when I think that some of the public, and maybe important times with the public, would have a memory and would say, you know, you guys don't have laws, you guys don't have rights anymore. And I think, you know, it's kind of like, I think once we've had it, to lose it would put us, would really run the risk of putting us back and in perhaps awful ways. I would not want to see that happen. I'm sure that there is a lot more speaking out, speaking up, and, you know, doing what we can that has to happen. Today I went into a brand new store that, and they've known me for years, but I've never said anything to them about ADA, but it was a brand new store built from the ground up, and I went looking for the restroom. From my tour, I remembered about where it was. I went and I felt the door to see if there was any raised lettering on it, and I reached to the right of the door, and sure enough, there was Braille there that said women's. And, you know, that would not have been there before ADA. And that's just one little thing that does make a difference.
Probably we all have to stick together and go out and fight for it if we wanted to do persevere, you know.
There isn't a lot of likelihood that the ADA would go away, because if the ADA does go away, then I think there's a pretty good case for suggesting that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 ought to be gone as well, as should Section 504. So I don't think it'll go away. I think what may continue to happen is the Supreme Court will continue to interpret the ADA as narrowly as it can. And that brings really us to the question of what we can do to promote the ADA. And I think the first thing is, we heard from Dave McElroy what a tough and lonely place it is to be a plaintiff in an ADA case. And perhaps we need to begin to provide encouragement and support and solace as well for people who have good potential ADA cases. We need to try to encourage people who really do appear to have pretty good cases to seek ways of filing those. I think we often are afraid to rock the boat, particularly those of us who are blind. And by the way, the Department of Justice clearly says that the population that per capita complains the least are people who are blind. And that, to me, is a very telling and significant statement. What can we do to improve things with regard to the ADA? I think there are four things that we can do. I think the first of them is we as local chapters, as state affiliates, and as the national organization need to recognize that we're dealing with new people every year. And at least every 2 or 3 years, I think at the national level and at the state level, we ought to do some ADA training to try to ensure that all our members know what the law says. One of the sad things to me is the degree to which ADA training has become a thing of the past, except where it's mandated. I think the second thing that we can and should do is we need to seek good ADA cases and try to provide support and encouragement to people who have them to actually take them forward through the courts. We need to begin to develop some better case law, and the only way to do that is by trying to encourage some of the really good cases to come forward. I think the third thing that we can and should do is to continue to contact our congresspeople at the Senate level and at the House level and make clear that we are extremely unhappy with attempts to subvert a whole branch of government which is to a large degree what this administration is trying to do by in effect stacking the membership of the Supreme Court. And fourth and last, I think we have to think seriously about whether we're actually at the place where we are likely to see more and more bad decisions and more narrow decisions which will gradually assume the capacity of being a law, unless we can somehow make that change. And I think that one of the ways that we might feel like we need to do that is by actually going back to Congress and writing, Joe will understand what I mean by this, something like an ADA Restoration Act. With Section 504, we did that because there were elements of the government and the court system who were interpreting the law too narrowly. I think if Congress were asked to open the ADA, we'd certainly be taking a risk because it might be that Congress would in fact determine that the ADA goes too far. And at the same time, as they were creating some of the system that I've suggested here, they might also narrow its scope and provisions. So I think there are lots that we can do and many things that we perhaps need to do.
Paul Sheen here from Canada. I've got friends in the U.S. My thoughts on the ADA are this. You know, it's been around for so long, and I think it really needs to be looked at once again. You know, I don't know. I'm not a U.S. citizen myself, but from what I'm hearing, it hasn't been revised in a number of years, and I think it's time it got looked at once again and to see what can be changed and what should be left alone.
I want to say one last thing here, and so far as my own personal experience was concerned in regard to ACB, and that is, I was told by several attorneys Dred F and various places that I had a good case, that 95% of the people did not, and that's why the laws were, that's why they were such a problematic. And of course, but ACB really did nothing. And I have to say that. And I don't know, I know this, Brian is not online tonight. He was the one, he was specifically said over one of the talk shows that I really ought to do this. I don't know if it's that there's no law to, you know, nothing to fall back on, but it just didn't happen. There was no support. I was by myself. And I won't forget that, Paul. I'm sorry, but I can't forget that.
Dave, I don't know what the circumstances were that surrounded your situation, and I don't know who you asked for assistance, and I have no idea why that assistance wasn't forthcoming or at the very least some support. But I certainly think it's an appropriate thing for you to raise here, and I think it is appropriate for us to recognize that one of the roles that we do play in ACB is we ought to represent a place where people who are taking the chance of putting their lives on the line in order to extend the coverage and the applicability of the ADA deserve our support and deserve our assistance and deserve to be perceived as not, as Dave saw himself, as absolutely alone through this whole process. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for tuning in this evening to the second program in our series on the ADA. I think we've managed to explore many elements of the ADA, and have also managed to accomplish many, at least notions of where the ADA might go. I think there's a lot for us to do, and I think that the civil rights of people with disabilities are certainly at a crossroads. It will be up to us and other people with disabilities to try to assure that instead of being narrowed, the recognition of real and important denials of our rights need to be challenged. And I hope that many of us will continue to do that. Thank you very much for listening this evening. I'd like again to thank Larry T. in Orlando for his wonderful job recording, Dave Williams for the job that he will do editing, and of course, I would like to thank George Byes of Talking Communities for making the server available to us. Most of all, I'd like to thank all of those who participated this evening in the recording of this program, and I'd like to thank all who will listen to this program on ACB Radio, connecting people who are blind throughout the world. Thanks for listening, and good night. Next week on Tuesday, Topics will begin a two-part series on sexuality in people who are blind. Are people who are blind the same as everybody else in terms of sex? Do we get interested in sex as early as others? What kind of an impact does going to boarding schools, such as schools for the blind, have on our sexuality? What about when we get older? How easy is it for us to get involved in intimate relationships? And what are some of the special problems that we face in those relationships? Next week, we will begin a two-part series that will explore some of these questions, and we hope that you will join us on Tuesday Topics on ACB Radio, connecting the blind community.